It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2021, Mordechai Yavne, the founder and manager of New York-based Focus Capital Management, a boutique long-only hedge fund launched in 2013. Focus Capital Management is a fund with a fairly unique approach to investing. The unique advantage comes from implementing and capitalizing on the value that concentration brings to an investor's portfolio. Mordechai believes that focusing his time, energy, research, analysis, and resources on his best ideas generates superior long-term returns with a reduced level of risk built into each investment. He aims to invest in 4 to 5 positions at a time and believes this concentration and the deep research that he invests in each of the positions is the driver behind Focus Capital Management's long-term success. Great to have you with us, Mordechai. I really look forward to your presentation. I will now turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John. It's an honor to present for the first time at Best Ideas 2021, and I'm thrilled to be here. Just a few words about myself. Like John just said, at Focus Capital Management, we believe in concentration, focusing all our time, energy, and resources on just a few select opportunities. We think that this gives us basically 3 main advantages. We believe that our focus allows us to do deep research and analysis to really understand the company we're investing in. We believe that our focus drives higher returns because we only pick our best ideas. We do not want to dilute our investments with mediocre ideas, even good ideas, only our best ideas. And we believe that our focus and concentration actually reduces risk by allowing us to thoroughly vet and stress test every investment when we make it. So really, Best Ideas Conference is what we do all year long and fits right into the strategy of our fund. So let's go right into it. Slide 3, Burford Capital, the leader in litigation finance. That's the company we're going to present on today. As you see on the next slide, there's a picture of a fraction, really, of the materials that we reviewed and analyzed in our quest to fully understand Burford Capital, litigation finance, and everything we could about this investment. So that's really our goal, to do our deep research. And then on the next slide, just a hat tip to Artem Fokin of Carol Can Capital, who introduced us to this idea of Burford back actually 2 years ago when he presented on it in Best Ideas 2019. We encourage you to read, to view his presentation, and on his website, he has other materials about Burford as well. He did a great job. I would also just start off by saying that anybody who's interested in learning more about Burford Capital, I encourage you to go read their annual reports, their interim reports, back from when they were founded in 2009. They're exceptionally well-written and informative to really give a view on litigation finance and what drives the companies forward. It's their strategy, the metrics, really well-written, and it's a very good starting place for research into Burford Capital. So let's go right into it. Our next slide is just describing what we're gonna do. We're gonna have an overview, then describe what is litigation finance, a little bit about the history of litigation finance, performance of the underlying investments, growth of the company, a little bit about the financials, valuation, and finally, why is this opportunity available? So starting with our overview. Burford Capital is the leading provider of litigation finance. They are far larger than any of their competitors. Litigation finance involves highly asymmetric investments. Many wins, a few outsized wins, and relatively few and smaller losses. So the underlying investments are highly asymmetric, which leads Burford to be highly profitable. Over 10 years, they've shown consistent IRRs in the 25 to 30% plus range, return on equity north of 20%, highly profitable, rapidly growing, with a cheap valuation after the market sentiment soured with the Muddy Waters short attack in 2019, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And besides the cheap valuation of the company has a whole nother segment of fund management, which is very underappreciated by the market. It's not showing up yet on the income statement, but it's going to start showing up in 2021 and beyond, adding real value to the company. And the cherry on the top is the Peterson case, which the market seems to be affording zero value to at the moment, but it can add real true value over time. We'll talk about that a bit as well. So what is litigation finance? Goes by many different names. The name we prefer is litigation finance. We feel that's broader and more encompassing of the many different types of finance that Burford does, not just simply funding a lawsuit like they started, but they branch out to many other areas, as we'll see. The definition of litigation finance. Litigation finance is deploy capital with expectation of receiving returns from successful litigation. That can be by providing finance to a corporate client. It could be by providing finance to a law firm where the law firm wants their hourly fee and the client wants a contingency fee arrangement. So Burford can bridge that gap between the law firm and the client by offering a contingency fee to the client, getting their reward from the successful litigation, but giving the law firm their hourly fees. It's not only necessarily just funding litigation costs, sometimes it's monetizing litigation, paying much more than the litigation costs might be, but accelerating a future litigation award in exchange for a portion of it. Funding asset recovery or even purchasing an asset whose main value is underlying litigation. Next slide, we have typical examples of their contracts. The basic thing to take out of this is that really the terms are bespoke. Every deal is its own, depending on the specifics of what the company needs, what Burford needs, the specifics of the specific litigation. It's a custom deal is made of terms for each and every litigation contract, whether it be a portion of proceeds, a multiple of the amount that Burford invests, some combination thereof, maybe an interest rate for how long it takes, et cetera, et cetera. Every deal is unique. Reasons client fund. So originally, maybe litigation funding was mostly for clients who couldn't afford the litigation, smaller corporate clients who didn't have the money for the top lawyers that they needed to hire to pursue litigation. But really, it's much broader than that now. Whether it be to de-risk litigation, of course, from the litigant's perspective, this is his one lawsuit, and it's much riskier for them than for Burford, where they can spread the risk across their entire portfolio. Public company accounting is a major reason why large companies who can definitely afford the litigation, but the litigation expenses count against their income. If they end up winning, they generally will not be credited for their wins in the market. The market will, most rightfully so, consider it a one-off. So it hurts them to pursue litigation. And if Burford takes expenses off their balance sheet, that's a win-win for everybody around. And other reasons, as you see on the slide, all sorts of different reasons why clients choose to fund litigation finance instead of paying for it out of pocket. There's a broad and varied field, be it a single claim in all sorts of areas, bankruptcy, investor state disputes, breach of contract, IP, fraud, international arbitration. And a major innovation, which Burford started in 2010 and has really become the majority of the business, is funding portfolios of claims. Instead of just funding one claim, if a corporation has many claims, or a law firm can have many claims across many corporations, across many areas of law. And Burford will fund a whole package cross-collateralized between them all. This has advantage for both Burford and the client. While single claims, this stats from a few years ago, but it's still basically current, a single claim has had a 19% loss rate for Burford. Portfolios of claims have had only a 3% loss rate because they had more claims underlying and supporting the portfolio. So they're able to offer better terms for the client, less expensive capital, and still make more money net for Burford. So that's really a win-win all around. And presently, their portfolio is about 75% portfolio claims versus 25% single claims, or even more than that in the portfolio direction. And as you see, they do many other things, even buying the underlying asset sometimes. They do asset recovery, which would be when after a court judgment, usually defendants pay right away. Sometimes the scoff laws, they choose not to pay, and they'll fund asset recovery in exchange for a portion of what they recover. Let's talk a little bit about the history of litigation finance. Historically, litigation finance has been considered illegal under the doctrine of champerty. That's been going away throughout the world, starting with Australia in the 90s, where they started allowing first for insolvency cases, and then they allowed it for all cases, and then the UK with the famous Jackson report on litigation costs. The government endorsed litigation finance as a means to further access for justice, especially with litigation costs and law, legal fees becoming more and more expensive over time. Governments throughout the world realized that it's important for access for justice to allow litigants to receive finance and funding from third parties to allow them to be able to litigate when necessary. And throughout the world, the trend has been to limit or entirely repeal champerty restrictions. Most recently, Singapore and Hong Kong in 2017 have repealed champerty in limited measure for international arbitration in Singapore and Hong Kong. Most US states no longer have the restriction of champerty as it applies to Burford as well. Moving along, regulation is highly individual depending on the specific jurisdiction, country by country, state by state. The thing I would most underline on this slide is really two things. One is control. That with the notable exception of Australia, most jurisdictions insist that the litigation funder should not have any control. That means they're not in charge of choosing the lawyer, not in charge of legal strategy, not in charge of accepting a settlement, vetoing a settlement. That's all up to the client. Burford is a passive investor who structures, chooses a litigation where they feel has a high degree of success, structures their terms such that the incentives are aligned between them and the client, between them and the law firm, and sits back and lets the client run the litigation. They can ask Burford for advice if they wish, but Burford does not control the litigation. And the second thing I would underline that this is entirely separate field from consumer litigation funding, where maybe a malpractice or a tort lawsuit from consumer against an insurance agency or whatever, and you have lots of companies that are gonna front money in exchange for a portion of litigation. That's entirely different, has its own set of regulations. Burford only deals with corporate litigation and sophisticated counterparties. On the next slide, we have abbreviated Burford timeline. Starting from the IPO in 2009, they raised money a few times with equity, a few times with debt. The two things I would just show here is that how they, over time, they started off with US litigation and international arbitration. And then over time, they entered the UK market, and then Singapore, Australia, et cetera. And now they're really a global market funding litigation finance across the world. The second thing I would point out is their acquisitions. They broadened from just being pure litigation funding. Starting 2012, they started offering insurance. 2015, they added asset recovery. And then the major acquisition in 2016, they acquired Gertchen Keller Capital, GKC, to become the world's largest litigation funder, and adding significantly fund management of third-party capital into litigation finance as part of the business. And we'll talk about that more, as that's really an underappreciated part of the business. Moving along, what are Burford's competitive advantages, their moats? So the first largest competitive advantage that Burford has is their size. Legal finance, litigation finance, litigation funding is often dealing with binary risk. If the lawsuit is lost, then the entire investment is lost as well. So with binary risk, you really need extensive diversification. And with legal fees on the rise, funding even one claim can easily be $5-10 million or more. And portfolio deals can easily be north of $100 million. So when you want to do that on a diversified scale, you really need to have lots of capital available, or really just cannot play in the space. And really, you could probably count just four or five competitors in the space that really are playing on Burford's level. And even the biggest of them is probably only a third or a quarter of Burford's size. So their size is probably the biggest advantage. And the second thing I would say is reputation and relationships. Due to the confidentiality of the legal process, these are typically not run as an auction process. They generally will approach the client, or the law firm will approach one or maybe two litigation funders to deal with. And Burford's size and reputation often brings that they get the deal first. Moving along to, let's discuss the performance of the underlying litigation assets. So on the next slide, we have the metrics. The main metrics that define litigation finance would be ROIC, which is return on invested capital. That's simply how much money they're making on the money they're investing. That does not take time into account. And then you have IRR, which takes time into account as well, the annualized return, taking into account the amount of time that capital is deployed. It does not take into account time where capital is sitting idle on Burford's balance sheet and does not take into account Burford's operating expenses and costs. It's purely a measure of performance of the underlying portfolio, the litigation finance that they invest in. And as it says here on the slide, ROIC and IRR often have an inverse relationship. Settlements, by virtue of settling, tend to have a shorter average life than matters that actually go to trial. Because of that, they have a low return. You settle for less than you're able to get at trial. That's the whole point of the settlement. So they have a lower return, a lower ROIC, but that leads to a higher IRR because the investment is outstanding for a shorter amount of time. Trials and arbitrations that come to adjudication, they have a longer average life and generally a higher return, but because of that, they often have a lower IRR. So there's like this balance between ROIC and IRR. On the next slide, we have the investment funnel and the basic thing to take out of this. This is the 2019 numbers. It's basically been like this for a few years. You're seeing 1,400 inquiries, inbound inquiries of people who are seeking litigation funding and only 99 final commitments. So basically we're talking 5-7% of the deals they're looking at are, did they finally close on? They're highly selective. It's typical for Burford and really typical across the litigation finance field. On the next slide, we have the slides actually taken from Burford's most recent interim report. It shows the what we were speaking about before, how their litigation funding is highly asymmetric. We're looking here at only the concluded, whether fully or partially concluded, balance sheet assets. So not the things they invested through their third-party funds. The things on the matters on the balance sheet, concluded only, ongoing, obviously we can't know what the return is yet. And as you see here, there are losses, but they're much fewer than the wins, and the wins are much bigger than the losses. You see here, all the way at the right end, you have some fantastic gains of even higher than 700% of return on invested capital. And there are 22, 23 matters which they've invested in since inception, which have more than a 200% ROIC, which means they more than tripled their investment, which just shows how profitable these can be. The next slide is again about the concluded balance sheet investments. I'd like to just really underline three things on this slide. First of all, as you can see, the majority of matters settle. 60% of the investments that they make end up in settlement, and they have never lost money yet on a settlement. So that's the first takeaway from the slide. The second takeaway from the slide is from the things that do go to trial, so 40% go to trial, of those, 30% are wins and 10% are losses, which means that 75% of the investments that they make that ultimately go to trial are wins, which shows and underlines how they are truly picking successful litigation to fund in and choosing wisely. And the third takeaway is just their total ROIC since inception on concluded matters is 97% with an IRR of 32% annually, which is really just fantastic returns. On the next slide, we have here the evolution of their performance over time. So this is the cumulative investment performance through 2013, and then again, from inception through 2014, from inception through 2015, et cetera, et cetera. You see that over time, the ROCA has actually improved till 97%, and the IRR, which is probably the more important number, is basically been stable, a little bit rising, but I would say stable between 25 to 30% over time, most recently as high as 32%, and the weighted average life of their investments has also been ranging up and down, but approximately in the two-year range. On the next slide, we've broken down their concluded investments by year when they made the investment, when they made the commitment. So what you see here is a few things I'd like to point out. Obviously, you see that the most recent matters, 2017, 2018, 2019, are mostly still outstanding. In 2017, 80% of matters are still outstanding. 2018, more than 90% are still outstanding. So these investments take time. But even going further back, 2015, 2016, still more than half of the investments that they made in 2015, 2016 are still outstanding, and are still items outstanding from 2010, 2011. So these things take time. And you also see that their performance is not purely from any one particular year. Across the years, they have very good ROICs, IRRs, et cetera. It's pretty balanced, their performance over time. Going on to the next slide, as I said, they have a broad-based performance, whether you analyze it by vintage, whether you analyze it by area of law, by geography, whether it's a settlement or a resolution or a trial, by size of the investment, small or large, you see that they have a very broad-based performance. They have for years been releasing detailed vintage and case-by-case summaries of their performance, and really could get a deep dive in there and see how broad-based their performance indeed is. Which brings us to the next slide to talk a little bit about Petersen. Petersen is a very successful investment that Burford made. Burford invested $20 million to date in Petersen, and they have already received $236 million back, and it's still ongoing with possibly hundreds of millions or even billions to come. To give a little bit about background about Petersen, Petersen and Eaton Park were investors in YPF, which is the National Oil Company of Argentina. Argentina privatized the National Oil Company, and they agreed and promised investors that if they ever renationalized YPF, that they would pay investors based on a set formula in the bylaws of the of YPF, which sets out exactly what formula they would pay investors if they nationalized the shares. In 2012, Argentina indeed did nationalize the shares and did not pay the investors. Repsol was a 50% owner of YPF, and they sued Argentina, and in the end, Argentina settled with Repsol for 50 cents on the dollar. Petersen was a 25% holder, Eaton Park is a 3% holder, and they sued, and the lawsuit is ongoing. What you show here in this table here shows various hypothetical possible outcomes of the YPF litigation. Whether you assume that they get the same 50 cents on the dollar that Repsol got, or you assume they get their legal rights from the bylaws formula as this case goes to trial. So Burford invested both in Petersen and Eaton Park, but Burford, as I said before, already made $236 million from Petersen, and that's because they sold part of their entitlement that they have in Petersen. They sold a little bit more than 38% of their rights, and they retained a little bit more than 61% of their rights from a successful Petersen outcome. So even if Petersen ends up losing, Burford made a mint. They invested $20 million and they've gotten already back $236 million. But as you see on the chart, if it continues and is ultimately a win, the amount of money that Burford stands to gain from Petersen and Eaton Park can easily be $1, $2, or even $3 billion. And that's before including the statutory 9% pre-judgment interest rate that they're entitled to, which would more than double the above figures. So it's really an awesome amount of money that Burford stands to make, larger than, in fact, an entire market cap. And the market is entirely discounting the Petersen value in Burford. But a lot of people see this as a potential flaw. They say, oh, Burford is just Peterson. They're just making the money from Peterson. They're not, they, without Peterson, they didn't really make so much money. So the answer to that is really two things. First of all, large wins are normal. Burford's litigation funding is highly asymmetric. We expect there to be, as we said before, many wins and a few outsized wins. And that is exactly, that's good for the company, and that's normal. But two, even if we exclude Peterson and we discount any money that they made from Peterson, and we examine the portfolio just ex-Peterson, they still had a return on invested capital of 69% and an IRR of 26%. So it's still very good. So it is really untrue to say that all their returns are really just in Peterson. That is simply false. Moving on, some people complain about that all this analysis that we've done so far is about concluded cases. What about the cases that are still ongoing? Maybe the ongoing cases are substantially worse than the concluded cases, and they're going to end up in losses. So first of all, I would just point out, again, said before, some cases just take long. That is natural. Just the way the legal field works, things take years and years. That's very normal. And more importantly, like I said before, they released for years detailed vintage and case-by-case summaries. You can go back and see how the various vintages started off mostly unconcluded and then over time became more and more concluded and the returns stayed solid. So it is simply no reason to believe that all ongoing cases are all losses. Only the concluded cases are going to make wins. There's really no difference in the likelihood of the ongoing cases and the concluded cases. And in addition, even if you would arbitrarily count all remaining pre-2017 cases as total losses, which would be totally arbitrary to say, and we're talking about, we said before, 2015, 2016, more than half are still outstanding. If we consider all those as losses, they would still have an ROIC of pre-2017 cases of 46% and an IRR of about 16%. So still very solid returns. Let's talk a little bit about the growth of Burford Capital. So on this slide just shows they have three different sources of capital: equity, debt, and very importantly, funds. And the only thing I would like to underline on this chart at the moment is they have 2.7 billion assets under management through third-party capital. And that is very underappreciated by the market because it's not yet hitting the income statement for reasons we will talk in just a moment. The next slide shows us the growth of balance sheet and commitments. This is the yearly commitments made every year in 2010, how many commitments they made, how many made in 2011 over time. And the two things I underline on this chart are you see the uptick in 2014 and 2015 as their commitments went substantially up from previous years. And then again in 2016 and especially 17, 18, and 19, they really went to a whole new level of commitments. And because litigation funding takes time to resolve, so these investments from 2017, 2018, 2019 really are not expected to start hitting the Burford's income until 2021 and beyond, because it takes an average of 4 to 5 years for these things to really start hitting the income statement. The next page, we have the total portfolio over time, as you see, growing substantially in 2017, 2018, 2019. And we have here also their portfolio. This is, by the way, deployments at cost, not counting any fair value gains, plus undrawn commitments that they've already made to clients of theirs, both for the balance sheet and for the balance sheet plus funds. So what does this mean for Burford's future? We saw before the average weighted life of investments are 1.8 years. However, that needs to be taken in context. That's 1.8 years, first of all, is from deployment. Typically, it takes an average of half a year from commitment to deployment. So it's really more like 2.5 years weighted average life from commitment. However, that is also the weighted average life of their concluded cases. Their ongoing cases typically are about as long and they're still ongoing. Overall, the entire portfolio would be expected to have a weighted average life of around 4 to 5 years. So 2 years to be concluded, when you take the ongoing cases into account and measure from commitment, I expect more of a 4 to 5 year overall weighted average life, which means that the step up in commitments that we saw in 2017 to 2019 is really going to start showing up in the income in 2021 and beyond. And then the next slide, just for a moment, talks about the fund management. What's important to understand is that most of their funds feature a European waterfall structure, which means that they invest the funds for the third parties, and then the litigation successes come in and they're making money. They still do not get any performance fee until first investors get back all their principal. Once all the principal goes back to the investors, then any future litigation successes, they start making their performance fees, which means that they don't make their performance fees until years after the investments are made, which is why mostly they haven't seen performance fees yet coming from the fund management, but it is starting to be unlocked at the end of 2020, and going on to 2021 and beyond is when we expect to start seeing major performance fees coming from the third-party funds. And we believe this is actually worth around one-third of the overall business and totally discounted by the market. And just for another moment, just a point about the Sovereign Wealth Fund. At the end of 2018, in December 2018, they raised a $1 billion fund, which is one-third funded by Burford, two-thirds funded by the Sovereign Wealth Fund. It actually has an American structure. It's relatively young, started investing in 2019. So there's really very little of the fund has been committed yet and deployed. Almost nothing has yet resolved from such commitments. And Burford, although only provides 33% of the capital, they receive 60% of the profits, which is an incredible 42% performance fee, which makes me think I should, you know, drop my hedge fund and start a litigation fund with such performance fees. And they also get reimbursed by the Sovereign Wealth Fund for a number of expenses. So they get millions of dollars reimbursed for expenses. I guess you call that kind of a management fee, plus a 42% performance fee, which is really an amazing leverage they have on third-party capital. Let's talk about the financials a bit. So this is the official income statement with a big X over it, because I think that their financials really have to be adjusted for a number of items before it can really be usable for investors' purposes. On the next page, we have here a short list of the major things it needs to be that we adjusted the financials for. We spent definitely more than 100 hours going through the financials with a fine-tooth comb and really understanding what the accounting was and getting a handle on it and adjusting it properly to get to where we believe is the best view for investors. There were changes over time in accounting methods. We normalized all that into one method of accounting. We deconsolidated the third-party funds that were consolidated into accounts. And then I'd just like to take a time to talk about fair value gains. When Burford invests in a litigation and the litigation goes to trial and they win, or it settles and they get money, so that's a gain. That's a very obvious cash gain. But what if even before it goes to trial or settlement, there's a favorable summary judgment, a favorable maybe trial judgment, which is still going to appeal. So Burford will analyze that and say that there's a fair value gain, that the litigation is worth more than what they paid for it. So a lot of investors are very turned off by such a fair value. Who says it's accurate? How do we know we can rely on it, etc.? So I want to make three major points about that. First, it's IFRS mandated. They really have to do that. They don't really have much of a choice. Two, the vast majority of their fair value gains is due to Peterson, which they sold to third parties and kind of had to mark to market to what the third parties paid for the litigation. But three, and the most important point, is that it's really irrelevant, because we agree with investors that we should not look at the fair value gains. We should look at cash accounting, and we redid the accounting on a cash basis. Burford has consistently provided both sets of numbers, and you're able to see for yourself, which is what we did, to look at this on a cash basis. And then there's some acquisitions that we adjusted accounting for slightly, and some other minor adjustments, which brings us to the adjusted income statement. this is going back from inception till now. The most recent half year on the right is highlighted in red. And we believe the most important line is that line highlighted in red, net income without fair value gains, not taking into account the fair value, just the net income over time. As you see, there's lumpiness depending on which year the litigation ends up resolving. There's lumpiness in investments. but over time, you see a clear trend up. Just a word about 2018. My income statement here shows a loss for 2018. If you look back at their accounting, it shows a major gain for 2018. the reason for that is basically, the major reason for that is that there was an investment that resolved and they received significant cash in 2018. But they received cash from selling the investment to a third party after the litigation win in arbitration. But the third party had a right in the unlikely event that the investment would be, the arbitration award would be annulled. In the extremely unlikely event that the arbitration award would be annulled, the third party buyer had a right to sell the investment for what they bought it for, to return it to Burford. So I made a decision that that really shouldn't be considered a fully concluded investment until 2019, when the annulment was no longer possible. So I basically just a question whether to count in 2019, 2018, it's moving $80 million of income from one year to the other. It's just a question of timing. If you look from 2017 to 2020, you'll see the average income over that time. It's approximately $80 million a year. And the other thing I just point out is that we're dealing with another $15 million of the GKC amortization, which is a non-cash amortization charge, not really relevant to investors who are buying in now. So we're talking really about a run rate of approximately $100 million income a year. So let's talk just a moment about the valuation. We could evaluate in two ways, earnings-based and asset-based. So on earnings-based valuation method, the share price as of Friday, January 15th, it closed at 878. Focus Capital Management itself purchased it at an average price of under six. In March of last year, there was available for a little while for under $4 a share. So their market cap is a little bit under $2 billion, at approximately $100 million of earnings over time. So we're talking about a P of approximately 20 for a very fast growing company. A P of 20 is extremely good deal. And that is not counting the fund management income and the Peterson. Fund management income is, as we saw, we expect the fund management to start contributing significantly to the bottom line starting 2021. Being that their fund commitments are approximately right now a billion and growing. Given their general IRRs of 30% and their average performance fee of actually north of 20%, we'd expect it to be contributing more than $50 million a year of performance fees over time. Starting a little smaller than that, but growing over time to $50 million plus, which really is adding another 50% of value to the company as a whole. And finally, the Peterson option, we believe the market is giving it zero value when in truth, Peterson alone could easily be worth more than the entire market cap of the company. So you kind of get that for free. You're getting a fast growing company at a cheap price with Peterson being sold, thrown in for free, which is just a great deal. If you look at it from an assets-based perspective, we have a simplified balance sheet, cash due from investments, which they have never had a cash due from investment that has not been paid. They usually get paid within the year. These are no different. Most of these due from investments are actually due to a lawsuit against the U.S. government that was resolved recently at the end of the first half of 2020. So that's getting paid as we speak and might even be resolved by, fully paid by now. they generally is not an issue of due from investments not being paid over time. Then they have the litigation investments at cost, not counting any fair value gains, of $856 million, but those are already 2 years into, average of 2 years into the cycle, being that they have IRRs of 30% per year, so they're really worth by now about $1.4 billion. Basically, if you take the market cap divided by the book value, if you value it at cost, it'd be 2.5 times. If you value it at their IRR worth, it's about 1.5 times the book value for a company that's showing IRRs of 25 to 30%, return on equity north of 20%, that is really a very good price to book ratio to be paying. Just one last slide, which is why is this opportunity available? So I would basically say a few things. One, I'm the first to admit that it's definitely complex accounting. There's a lot to wrap your heads around. It takes time to research this and to really get comfortable with the company and all, but there's a really a massive data that they provide, really transparent, and you can really, it takes time, effort, and work to understand the company, but I believe that's definitely a fruitful endeavor for investors who want to invest in Burford Capital. The second issue, I believe, is people are not comfortable with fair value gains. As I spoke before, I don't think that's an issue at all, because it's fully within your rights to analyze this, as we did, totally discounting any fair value gains, looking just on the cash accounting. The third is people who are nervous about Peterson. As I said before, that's really, I mean, I don't see what there is to be nervous about. It was actually a very successful investment for them. Even if you do not count Peterson, they have been historically quite profitable without Peterson as well. And the remaining amount of Peterson and Eton Park that is quite possibly going to bring in more money than the market cap is worth, just a free option, I don't see why that's a concern. It's only a cherry on the top. Fourth would be the Muddy Waters short attack in 2019. Muddy Waters, basically, they cherry-picked a few investments, which they had some complaints about. Burford thoroughly debunked that with their response. And the fair value gains and Peterson that Muddy Waters discussed, we've already discussed. We don't really see any issue with any of the issues that Muddy Waters brought up. We believe actually a lot of the drop that was engineered by Muddy Waters was probably due to four sellers. There were two major mutual funds that were had large amounts of shares of Burford, but had to liquidate. And the funds were liquidating, and they were large owners of Burford, the two largest owners of Burford, and they kind of had to sell into the market with a short attack going on. Could in fact be that that's why Muddy Waters chose this company to do a short attack to, and that probably brought the stock down a lot. The one issue that that Muddy Waters did bring up that was legitimate was corporate governance. They founded in 2009, smaller company. They IPO'd on the AIM market. Over time, the much larger market, people are not so comfortable with the AIM market. Also, the CEO and the CFO were husband and wife. And that's definitely something that I would not be comfortable with. And I can imagine many investors are not comfortable with. And that was a legitimate issue that Muddy Waters brought up. Burford addressed the issue with a new CFO. They've revamped the board to best practices, and they've uplisted a dual listing to the NYSE, New York Stock Exchange. So they really beefed up the corporate governance. And really, I would say that Muddy Waters was really a blessing for investors. One, it actually brought the ability to buy Burford at a much cheaper price. And two, it prompted Burford to release a lot more data, both in their response to Muddy Waters and then in the 2019 annual report, the 2020 interim report. They released a boatload of data and increased the transparency even beyond what it was before, which was pretty transparent. But they gave more data of the underlying investments and slicing and dicing the information in different ways, and really makes it much easier to become comfortable with Burford as an investment. So I think it's a great investment. I'd love to, anybody who has any questions, comments, feedback, please reach out to me, myavna@focuscapitaladvisors.com. Email's on the first slide. I'd love to hear what you have to say. talk by email or set up a time to talk over the phone, that would be great. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mordechai, very much for this presentation. Just a few questions from me, and then I'll encourage our members to feel free to reach out to you, as you just offered, with their own thoughts and questions. In terms of the opportunity here and the size of the market, if you will, in order for Burford's results to scale exponentially, I guess the available litigation opportunities have to scale exponentially. Can you just talk more about, you know, how big the market is and you know, how much or how little is being addressed through litigation finance today?
That's a great question. It's an insightful question. And the answer is, it's hard to know precisely how much of the legal market is totally addressable, but it's really a huge, huge market. If you look just at law firm fees are estimated globally to be over $800 billion in legal fees annually. The U.S. alone is just the 200 largest law firms in the U.S. have revenue of $118 billion a year. So that's really quite a lot of a greenfield area where they're just dipping their toes in the market. Not all of this is obviously addressable. Not all of it is necessarily litigation fees. Not all of it is the type of litigation that makes sense economically to fund, nor necessarily do all the litigants want to fund. But there's really a huge market out there. That's just looking in terms of the legal fees. If you look at the value of the settlements, judgments, and awards that are being pursued, which is, in other words, not so much how much they're funding, but how much they stand, what the pie that they stand to take a share of, and what they're monetizing, is easily north of trillions of dollars a year. It's really hard to get a precise number on that, but it's definitely in the trillions, not the billions. So it's really a huge market out there. And with their $2 billion portfolio, they're really only scratching the market at the moment.
As the company does litigation finance, both with its own capital as well as for third parties, can you just talk a little bit more about how much of the future value do you see being kind of as a principal versus as a fund manager for others?
So that's a good question. At the moment, where the fund, their fund management for others is about $1 billion, and their portfolio is about $1 billion at the moment of deployments. So I would expect that because they make more money on their own capital invested than on what they're investing for others, the fund management is really only providing around a third of expected income in the future compared to their own investments. But going forward, the fund management can really expand a lot. They can raise more money for their own. You know, besides reinvesting their own capital, they can raise more money through debt or equity. But really, third-party capital is tremendously advantageous, where they're able to have 42% performance fees on third-party capital and not have any financing costs for that capital at all. It's really something that they can grow more and more. At the moment, I believe it's about contribute income about a third, but I think that can easily grow to maybe equal half of the company's value or more, depending how they choose to raise future capital.
In terms of capital allocation, is it fair to say that basically they're just reinvesting everything into litigation finance in terms of organic growth, or do you see at some point a scope for return of capital?
They have historically offered a dividend. I think that's more common among British companies and US companies. They offered a dividend. Personally, I'd really prefer that they didn't offer any dividend and just reinvested the money because they have such great returns available to them. because of COVID, they chose to suspend the dividend for a short time so that they can be certain about capital requirements for funding future cases without having any issues, just in case there would be a prolonged slowdown in the litigation world. The truth is that litigation continues on even once I mentioned COVID. Litigation continues even in the face of COVID. Certain items, things, trials by juries, are suspended across much of the world, but hearings, video conference trials in front of the judge are continuing. So I just basically say two points. One is that litigation finance is not like a restaurant. If the restaurant is not serving customers today, then it's lost income. Tomorrow, they're not going to serve double the amount of meals. For litigation finance for Burford, it's basically deferral, not not loss of income. Whatever, any litigation that's not happening now, so that's just going to happen next year. And two, Burford often has structures and investments and such that if there is a delay in resolution, they actually get paid more for that. The longer it takes to resolve, the higher a share of the resolution that they make. So any delay due to COVID can actually be on the counterparty, not on Burford. So they don't necessarily really lose from COVID. And three, in the long term, COVID, with the financial disruption that it brought with it, is likely to actually increase litigation across the world, as well as increase the appetite of litigants to choose to get third-party funding instead of dipping into their own capital to fund. So that's probably just good for them.
And lastly, from me, in terms of competition, should we have any concerns there in terms of how easy it is to get into this space, either on the fund management side, and it certainly looks attractive given the fee structures you mentioned, or on the principal side, that perhaps some very large law firms could make this a line of business. How do you think about that?
I'll take that in both steps. First, just talking about specialist firms to open up either through raising equity or through third-party funds. The fields have been around for a while. Burford itself was founded in 2009. In the years since, there have been some funds started, but there are not that many funds that have been started at the level of Burford. I would say there probably hasn't been anything started since 2013 at Burford's level. It's really hard to invest in lawsuits and litigation without a really substantial team of highly paid lawyers. Burford has more than 100 people on staff, more than 55 lawyers. It's not something that you could dabble in. You really have to go in all the way. Like I spoke before, the size of claims and portfolio claims are really so massive, and you need extensive diversification. So it's really not that easy to get into, which is why there are only a few players, probably Harbor Litigation, Omni Bridgeway, Therium, maybe Parabellum, and maybe one or two others that are really playing at in the space and the size and the area of the market that Burford is addressing. As for the other thing you said about law firms, there's a tendency for a litigation funding to be done by specialist firms who do only litigation funding. And the reason for that is that firms who have customer relationships other than litigation funding often find that their customers get upset if their law firm, if their bank, let's say, is funding their competitor or the litigant that's suing them, and that doesn't make for good customer relationships. Credit Suisse used to have a division that invested in litigation. They had this problem. They eventually spun it off as Parabellum to be a pure play specialist litigation funder. And I think law firms and banks, et cetera, pretty much have this problem where it's hard for them to fund competing law firms and competing businesses against their clients. And I don't think it's really possible. It really mostly has to be done by specialist firms.
Great. Well, Mordechai, I will leave it here. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. It was truly a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. Have a nice day.
You too. Goodbye.